New pictures of Mars sent from Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory, which landed in an incredible feat of engineering earlier this month, are once again stoking public excitement about the Red Planet. Recently on the Naked Scientist podcast, we discussed the plans for the rover and what it's hoping to find at the landing site. You can find that at thenakedscientists.com/podcasts.
Now, Curiosity is just the latest in a long line of space missions to Mars. By my count, I think, incredibly, it's the 34th spacecraft we've launched to Mars. Joining us to explain some of the history of Mars missions is Oxford University Emeritus Professor of Physics, Fred Taylor. Fred, welcome to the show. Why does Mars have such an appeal to space scientists?
Well, I think the main reason is that it's another world and it's close by. And when we look at it, we see a lot of parallels with the Earth. So there's a basic excitement just about traveling to other worlds. And I think a lot of us have been brought up on science fiction concepts of Mars as well, and we'd like to know the truth. From my own point of view, I started out in Earth atmosphere science, and we're all very obsessed at the moment with things like climate change and so on, which involves understanding the physics of atmospheres. And you can learn a lot about that as well by taking another example. One of the problems with the Earth is, you know, we have the one example to examine, and we're worried about change, and we'd quite like to experiment with it. We'd like to change it so we can see what happens. But of course, that's not so nice if you're trying to live on the surface. A second best to that would be to look at the behavior on an Earth-like planet. And here we have Mars, which has undergone enormous climate change. We know that. And Venus, which has a serious greenhouse effect. So we like to look at those and look at the Earth as a member of a family.
I guess also you don't have the very long travel time that you have a spacecraft travelling to the outer gas giants.
Yes, that's true. And of course, the gas giants are not really very Earth-like. I mean, they're fascinating. There's all sorts of exciting things going on. And Titan, which you're discussing later, is a very Earth-like body in many ways. But if you really are trying to sandwich the Earth between planets that are hotter and colder, but with very similar kind of climate mechanisms going on, do you choose Mars and Venus? But Mars has always been everybody's favorite because Venus is covered with cloud. The surface is too hot to be hospitable. Mars is a bit on the cold side, but not so bad that we couldn't walk around there. And one of these days we will, and everybody knows that, and we're all looking forward to that.
You've alluded to the science fiction angle, but of course, long before we could go and explore Mars for ourselves, we had images of Mars and the famous story of the canals on Mars as well. So have these sorts of things helped to stoke our interest in it, knowing that it's been part of popular culture for as long as we've been able to see it?
Yes, I think it has. Of course, now we're in the space age. It's a different kind of game. But for centuries, people, of course, are fascinated about Mars. They assumed it was Earth-like in many ways, and that there was probably life there, and that one could travel there if only you had the means, which were not quite available then, but they are now. And the amount of speculation that's gone on through human history is just going to the earliest times is very great. Now we have the luxury of actually solving questions that people have asked for centuries.
I always find it fascinating quite how young our modern understanding of Mars is. I recently found myself browsing a copy of the Encyclopaedia Britannica from the 1960s, which told me that whilst there probably weren't animals on Mars, there might well be plants. I guess the data from the first spacecraft must have come of quite a rude shock to the author of that article.
Yes, I think it did. There was a really quite solid belief, as recently as when I was a child, and I like to think I'm not that old, that there probably was vegetation on the surface of Mars. By that time, everyone knew the atmosphere was fairly thin and that the surface was pretty cold by Earth standards and pretty dry by Earth standards. But it was still thought that some sort of tough moss or lichen could grow on Mars. There were various phenomena that you could see through telescopes that did indeed look like vegetation. There were seasonal changes on the surface of Mars, the so-called wave of darkening and changes in the polar caps and so on, that really seemed quite consistent with the idea of some plant life. Turns out now that, of course, what we were observing were inorganic phenomena. They were meteorological changes with the seasons rather than life. And the canals went away when the views of Mars got better, particularly from the first spacecraft.
Now, it's interesting that shortly after the space race, the exploration of Mars seemed to go out of fashion. In fact, I think after the successful Viking 2 landing in 1975, there wasn't another successful mission until 1996. Was that merely that the funding ran out at the end of the space race?
Not exactly, no. It was 76, actually. I was at JPL then and watched it all happen. That was my first involvement in Mars missions when I was a young postdoc. And there was huge excitement about Viking, the first landings, the first views of the surface. And the problem with Viking, of course, was that everything worked beautifully, but the expectation that some kind of life would be detected, bacteria at the very least, was dashed. And I think that disappointment set the program back quite a bit, not so much because people didn't think it was worth going there, but because you had to sort of regroup and think, well, we've thrown everything at it and it didn't work. So we've got to approach the whole thing differently. That's part of it, I think. And there was an element of disappointment. I think people really thought that when you landed and did some decent experiments, you probably would find some kind of life. And we didn't. But I think the other part of it was, that the space shuttle was under development then, and NASA's money was going into that very heavily, and it was having a lot of problems under development. Plus, the commitment was being made at that time also to start flying missions further afield to the outer solar system, which again was very expensive. So Mars just sort of edged its way under the back burner a little bit for a while, but it never really went away, and it came back strongly.
So in the modern age of Martian exploration, what are the big science questions we're trying to answer?
Well, it depends who you are. Everybody thinks of the life question, and I think that that has to be the top of everybody's list. For me, as I alluded earlier, coming from a background of studying the Earth's climate, and we're currently studying climate on Venus and indeed on Titan, we certainly want Mars to be part of that suite because we know there's been enormous climate change on Mars. The evidence there shows larger changes in the climate than any evidence we have anywhere else, including Earth. So there's a powerful climate change mechanism on this Earth-like planet, which, where the physics of the climate and the atmosphere are very similar to the Earth, which we would like to go and understand. So in terms of my day-to-day work, that's top of the list for me. On top of that, there's the whole question of understanding the origin and evolution of the Earth and the planets and the solar system. We'd all like to understand that, and Mars is a key part of that, so we need to gather data that helps us to understand where the whole thing came from and how it evolved. Finally, there's the pure exploration aspect, I think, because it's there kind of thing.
So what's the evidence for this climate change, and how have Spirit and Opportunity helped us to understand it?
Oh, the evidence is so clear that it's actually mostly been gathered from orbit, the kinds of experiments we're doing now with Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. You can see quite clear evidence for coastlines, river deltas, river valleys, runoff from precipitation. There are the polar caps, which are solid water ice, and the carbon dioxide ice varying seasonally. But the geological record, that's so clear you can even read it from space, shows that Mars used to be much more Earth-like, with liquid water on the surface, with running water, and with clouds and rain.
I think there were also some meteorites on the surface that were rather interesting.
Yes, and the exposed rock faces in the small craters that they visited were even better. Once you get into being able to see strata of ancient rocks, then you're going back in time when you look at these and analyze them. And one of the big discoveries by Spirit and Opportunity was the amount of sulfate deposit there is on Mars. Sulfates are produced in watery environments, and so are carbonates, which have proved to be much rarer, but they must be there. They're probably at a greater depth than Spirit and Opportunity were ever able to probe. And I'll bet you that in a year's time, we'll be talking about measurements by Curiosity of carbonate deposits in Gale Crater.
And speaking of Curiosity, it's often been described as being the size of a family car. How does it compare to Spirit and Opportunity?
Oh, it's much bigger. It's about 10 times bigger. And yes, it is. It is rather like a car. It's actually, I think it weighs pretty much exactly the same as a Mini Cooper, I think is the analogy NASA likes to use. So it's very much larger. It's much more powerful. It's nuclear powered rather than using solar cells, so it can go further and faster and climb steeper hills and all that kind of thing. But the main thing is it can carry a lot more scientific payload. And that means bigger instruments, more sophisticated instruments to do analysis.
If size, weight, engineering wasn't a problem, what sorts of instruments would we actually want to be putting on Mars if we could just teleport them there?
Oh, I think top of the list would probably be a big drill. And there are plans to do this. When I say a big drill, I mean a really big drill, something that's capable of going down maybe half a mile or further. Because the warm, wet era on Mars that I was alluding to has left deposits that we'd like to examine. But in the lowlands, these deposits are buried under millions of years of accumulation of soil. So we have to go fairly deep to find the water that's there now, which is frozen at the higher levels, but probably liquid further down. And also the remnants of that more Earth-like time. So drilling down is the thing. Now, Curiosity can drill a short distance. The European rover, which will be launched in a few years' time, has a somewhat deeper drill. It can go down about 2 meters. But as I say, we'd really like hundreds of meters or even thousands of meters would be great. But to do that, you have to erect a huge sort of derrick and feed drills in piece by piece. And it's not the sort of thing you can do from even the size of Curiosity. It would take a much bigger effort, possibly even involving humans actually assembling it and operating it.
Now, how did NASA go about selecting a site for landing Curiosity?
You assemble a team, actually several teams of people that are interested and knowledgeable, and you have hundreds, I nearly said thousands, it might be thousands, I lost count, of meetings. And you argue, and you people develop favorites, and they make the case for that, and people with other favorites try to shoot them down, and there's a sort of bun fight, which lasted over many years. There are lots of these meetings, lots of different views expressed, lots of candidates. I think the last count I saw, there'd been nearly 150 candidate launch sites considered, and that was narrowed down to about 6 a few years ago, 2.5 years ago. And these 6 were studied in massive detail, using in part the instruments that are already at Mars on the satellites orbiting Mars that are still operating. Most importantly, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is a very large satellite with big instruments on it, spectrometers and cameras. So once the sites had been narrowed down to 6, they were studied minutely with the high-resolution camera and the other instruments. And then there was a final battle, and Gale Crater came out top. But there are plenty of other good places that you could really have spun a coin and still come up with something good because there was so much choice.
And how long can we expect Curiosity to carry on exploring Gale Crater?
It's designed to operate for a Martian year, which is 2 of our years approximately. But it's capable of going on much longer than that. And as we know, Spirit and Opportunity far exceeded their nominal lifetime. So once the first Martian year is up, it's very likely that it will continue. NASA has to vote extra money to keep the teams together and so on. But I'd be very surprised if they don't do that as long as the rover is still operating and still healthy, because it can keep moving around and finding new sites and climbing mountains and things like that. So it's anybody's guess how long it will actually be. It depends on fortune to a considerable extent, but I would have thought we could look forward to 4 or 5 years with just a modicum of luck.
Thanks very much, Fred. That's Fred Taylor, Emeritus Professor of Physics at Oxford University, and we will come back to Fred later on in the show with your questions about Curiosity.